From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. New Hanover County's NAACP celebrates its 100th anniversary this year. Founded nationally in 1909, the local chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People launched 10 years later. The civil rights group articulates its mission this way: to ensure the political, educational, social, and economic equality of rights of all persons, and to eliminate race-based discrimination. Today, we're going to talk with two leaders of the organization about where things stand now and what's on the agenda for the centennial. Deborah Dix Maxwell is the president of the New Hanover County chapter of the NAACP. Deborah Dix Maxwell, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much.
Jessica Franks is president of the Wilmington NAACP Youth Council, and she is the Juvenile Justice Chair for the North Carolina NAACP Youth and College Division. Jessica Franks, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And we are inviting you to join the conversation. How do you think this region is doing on the equality front? You can call us during the live discussion on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And we'll start with the national dialogue that is springing from the Virginia governor situation. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam and his Democratic successors are facing calls to step down as they insist on powering through after revelations that Northam and other whites used blackface in their younger years. Trevor Noah is a comedian, and he's host of The Daily Show, and here's what he had to say about it to John Dickerson of CBS This Morning.
It's an interesting conversation that I feel like we need to break down into so many pieces. First of all, I think a lot of people are hurt when you keep getting reminders of where America has come from and where America is for many people. You know, to see somebody who's in power and you look back and you go like, oh, you were wearing blackface, you were part of this organization. And even if he says that that wasn't him, he says he wore blackface for a Michael Jackson competition. I think a lot of the time it reminds people of a conversation that hasn't been had in America, it feels like. And that's a conversation around race and America's past. And a lot of people say, oh, but it's over now. It's like, yes, but you still have to have the conversations around it. And to his credit, Governor Northam does say, he says he wants to have the conversations. And I think you need to, because like, you keep going further and further down the chain, you're gonna find more and more blackface in Virginia. It's not gonna end.
Right, yeah.
And so we like to think that we can fire a person or we can get rid of somebody when we find something like this. But that doesn't solve the problem.
Exactly.
That doesn't have the conversation.
Right.
And someone took that photo of him, someone put that photo in the yearbook, someone stood next to him in that photo, everyone was in that community. So the larger conversation is, in Virginia, what conversations do they need to be having around race and everywhere else?
Deborah Dix Maxwell, is this something that's history? Is it over?
Given the current political and climate, no, it's not over.
And so when Trevor Noah suggests that you can't solve the problem by firing people, Jessica Franks, how would you respond to that? Do you agree with his position on this?
I feel like it stems all the way to voting the candidate in. It really shows us that we really have to take this seriously, and we have to really make ourselves knowledgeable of our candidates that we are putting in office.
So you feel like there was an oversight way before the revelations came out, just the fact that people didn't know that this was in his history.
Yes.
What do you think, either of you, Deborah Dix Maxwell, about the fact that it's not just Governor Northam? They're discovering this kind of history among more white people in the Virginia state government.
Given the age of the, not just say candidates, the politicians, there will be more, and not just Virginia, if someone decided to unearth these things. Because at that time, you're talking about 70s, 60s, 80s, it was commonplace and it was politically correct and appropriate and acceptable for them in those areas to do what they did. Now in 2018, it is not. They're having repercussions within their workplace, within their political stature, but at that time, no one really bothered. Yes, that was the height after the Civil Rights Movement, but it was isolated in vacuums. So our national agrees for the resignation, but you also have to have cultural sensitivity and diversity training, because eliminating a position does not eliminate the problem.
So you're saying that in between the 1960s and 1980s, this was an acceptable part of white culture?
In some places, there were. The first time I was ever called that N-word was in South Orange, New Jersey, but yet I'm a North Carolina native, walking down Orange Avenue in the 70s. People stood together and worked together in some combines and isolations, and they were allowed to do that.
Trevor Noah also raises the issue of having the conversation. He talks about the fact that we haven't really had the conversation. And there are a lot of elements of that, but I'd like to ask you, which elements of the conversation do we really need to have that we aren't having or haven't yet?
We really need to have a conversation about acceptance of diversity. You have to remember that Little Rock was not that long ago. Neither was Brown versus the Board of Education. There are still some people who are living, who lived that. So therefore, we have not gone that far. We've had one or two generations since then in this country, but we haven't come to the table to really be accepting of the diversity of this country. And those who don't look like me need to get more accepting, because this country is turning more brown than it is white. So, you know, a lot of these things that are occurring now are power plays to suppress people of color out of the rightful spots within the political structure of this country.
Jessica Franks, as president of the Wilmington NAACP Youth Council, and also working at the state level on juvenile justice with the Youth and College Division, what is your generation talking about? Like, what's on the agenda for you?
One of the things that we're definitely hitting on is our voter engagement, as well as our safety within our schools. We cannot stress enough how important it is for our children to be safe in schools and learning as much as they can. We still, as well as we cannot stress how important it is for people to get out and vote. We have a lot of people who do not believe the importance of voting. We have a lot of people who do not know their role in voting. And so one of our main points is to actually go out and engage people to vote and make sure that they're knowledgeable of how important it is.
Considering a majority of North Carolinians passed a constitutional amendment last November requiring photo ID to vote, what does that make you think? Now, I'm making an assumption here that the NAACP would have been against that constitutional amendment. Is that fair?
Yes.
Now, for those who are listening and for those who voted for that constitutional amendment, who aren't engaged in any kind of voter suppression, aren't trying to deprive anybody of their right to vote, can you explain why the NAACP opposed the idea of showing an ID to vote? Because I think there is a cultural gap sometimes in the understanding of the circumstances that might prevent somebody from having an ID.
Yes. The reason that we vote against having photo ID in order to vote is because we have a lot of people, especially in our African-American communities, who do not have photo IDs. Some people have not been able to go to the DMV to receive a license. We have some older or our more seasoned generation who have not had a license since they've been born. So
somebody then who is supporting this amendment is going to say, but there are mechanisms. There are free mechanisms where you can go and maybe you don't need to drive a car, but you can get a state-issued ID.
But that requires transportation to that facility. That also eliminates people who were born at home who need another type of form of ID sometimes, because we have people in their 60s and 70s who were born by midwives in their house.
Who don't have a birth certificate, you're saying.
It also discriminates against people of a lower social and economic status, regardless of race, because they are a more transient population. And therefore, if I get an ID today that says I'm on McCray Street, and next week I'm on Gray Street, then my ID is not valid. Luckily, that's the same precinct, I believe, so I could get away with it. But what if I move all the way across town? That eliminates my right to vote within my precinct.
And so what is the way forward now for the NAACP in light of this constitutional amendment?
We always will fight legally against that, but we will also prepare to assist people because 2020 is right around the corner.
And I want to go back to this discussion we started with about blackface. We had a call. Mark from Wilmington says, I'm an instructor at Cape Fear Community College. He says, I teach about the minstrelsy every semester, and I'm surprised, he says, about how little my students know about it. Our students and population need to understand the troubled history of our country. Would you agree with that? We're not teaching the significance of blackface, really. And so some white people, is that an excuse? Stumble into it? And Deborah Dix Maxwell, you're shaking your head.
It's not an excuse to stumble into it.
And I'm going to ask you to expand on that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with two leaders from the local NAACP, Deborah Dix Maxwell and Jessica Franks. When we return from the break, we're going to hear from some more listeners, and you can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the new Hanover County NAACP. We're taking a look at how far equal rights for all people has come since 1919. With two local leaders, Deborah Dix Maxwell is president of the new Hanover County chapter of the NAACP. Jessica Franks is president of the Wilmington NAACP Youth Council and is the juvenile justice chair for the North Carolina NAACP Youth and College Division. You can weigh in today or ask your own question during this live Thursday discussion by calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. And Deborah Dix Maxwell, just before we went to break, you were starting to answer the question about why an ignorance about the history of blackface is no excuse for stumbling into the usage of it. So help us understand what this means from where you sit.
From where I sit, it's degrading. It's insulting, and it was so pervasively acceptable during the earlier part of this country, and people thought it was acceptable, not realizing the sensitivity that it caused. And therefore, we have continuous problems, especially with our European friends and neighbors who continually use blackface. Every year, there's something else that they are doing, so then it tells people in America, if they're doing it, it's okay, but it's not acceptable.
Now, there have been discussions parsing the difference between, say, dressing up in that photo of Governor Northam, where you have a character who is obviously the one in blackface, who is obviously denigrating kind of, you know, it's a negative comment on a person of color, a cartoon. And then next to that is a person who's dressed as a member of the KKK in the white robes and hats. And then you have people dressing up for Halloween as, say, Michael Jackson or a member of the Spice Girls. Is there a difference? And if not, why?
The difference is the people, last ones you mentioned were celebrities. People wore certain signature trademarks, maybe the glove or the short pants with the shoe, with the socks showing for Michael Jackson or the Spice Girls. They did nothing that was derogatory to any race, creed, or color as entertainers. But the groups mentioned earlier, the KKK and people wearing blackface, these were things that were done purposely to denigrate people of color.
Right.
Known.
So if you have a white person, say, during Halloween dressing up as one of these famous entertainers, a white person dressing as a person of color and using blackface as part of that costume. Right. So that's what I'm asking. Explain
then
that reaction.
I got a problem. You know, be comfortable in the skin you are in. You can imitate Michael Jackson without putting blackface on. It's quite easy. Or a Spice Girl. But be comfortable with the skin you're in. And it's very insulting to anyone to try and do something like that.
Because of the mechanism of blackface, the history of the usage of blackface
itself.
That is
not taught. There's so many things that are not taught in American history. We could be here all year long about that.
And maybe we should. Jessica Franks, you also led the March for Our Lives rally.
Yes, ma'am.
This was a year ago. Is that right?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
That experience was disheartening. I actually remember about a year ago being in a classroom when that happened. And instantly my heart broke.
And this is connected to
the Parkland, Florida shooting. Yes,
where
ma'am.
Students were killed.
Yes. I just could not believe that students who were trying to get all of the education that they could instantly lose their life because of something that is so unexpected. And I can only imagine how a parent feels losing their child for something unexpected. And a lot of times what happens is I do not feel that it is okay for our students to now go to school, sit in the classroom, and have a thought of not being able to go back home to their parents after they leave that classroom. It is completely unacceptable.
So why was the march that you led here disheartening to you?
The march that we led, it wasn't disheartening. It was actually I believe every one of the students who led that march, who organized that march, who spoke at that march, felt a sense of comfort from our community because we had so many supporters that supported us as we took a stand for this. And not only that, but they gave us the encouragement to continue on this fight for gun violence within schools.
And, of course, we should note that today is the anniversary
Yes.
of the Parkland shooting. You spoke, Deborah Dix Maxwell, about what's not taught in schools. And, of course, this area is loaded with some interesting history that rises to national interest, that it's the site of the only coup d'etat, the only recorded coup d'etat in American history. Is that something, Jessica Franks, that you learned about in school? I mean, I'm noting that the two of you are of different generations,
mm-hmm.
and you are on the youth council.
Yes. I did not learn that in school. I actually learned it at a summer camp called Sankova. And this summer camp is sponsored by the local branch, NAACP, and that is actually where I began my journey being a part of the NAACP. I remember sometimes before even being able to be at the age of going to the summer camp, I would go to the public library downtown with my mom, and she would allow me to, go and get some books on some famous activists within our African-American community. But in going to the summer camp, that is where I learned most of the African-American history.
Do you think that your parents, your mom, did she know about 1898?
No, she did not.
And just for those listeners who aren't familiar with it, that's when a group of prominent white politicians engineered a plan to get, they got a white mob to oust African-American elected officials from office and drive citizens from their homes in Wilmington. We don't really know how many people died that day. Estimates range from a dozen to several hundred. And that's something that we've certainly discussed on this program before. But you don't think your mother knew?
My mom actually did not know. She didn't grow up in Wilmington. But, of course, my dad, he learned about it because his parents grew up during that time. And so he knew a little bit about it. He knew a lot about the other significant places within our community because he grew up here. But my mother, no, she did not know because she did not grow up in Wilmington.
Do you remember how old you were when you went to camp and learned about it?
Oh, goodness. I believe I was about 12 years old, 12, 13 years old.
Okay, and you're nodding, Deborah.
That's the acceptance age, 12.
And what did that mean to you, Jessica Franks, when you learned about that? Because the way you talk about learning about some of the African American history here, it's like that was a life shift for you.
It was, actually. That is when I began to learn exactly who I was and how important it was for me to, and as well as my friends, to learn this history. Because one of the things that I always knew that my ancestors did so much to me, but until I learned exactly what they did for me, I didn't take it as seriously as I should have. And so now I am so grateful that folks who did not even think I would exist, folks who didn't even know who I was or the person I would become, actually take the time out to fight for me and my freedom.
Deborah Dix Maxwell, is there any movement do you see any movement in terms of getting some of this history into the curriculum in local public schools?
Not as big a movement as there should be, because this is important to understand about 1898. It changed the fiber of not only this city, this state, and this country.
How? Tell us how.
When you decimate a population, take away their businesses and their land, you change the political and economic landscape of African Americans, which has never rebounded in this city. Some families have never returned, and other incidents occurred all across the country during that time frame or afterwards.
Can you, for a listener who, say, is not from this area and moved in and hasn't really known much about it, can you point to something, a phenomenon here that you can say is really kind of a result or some residue left over from that time?
There were businesses down here. Like, my classmate's grandfather had a shoe shop. You don't see how many black businesses within the 5 blocks of this radius right now. And you don't have it. You look at the structures of the churches here. You knew that they were great artisans and craftsmen who not only built the African-American churches, but the beautiful foundations of the white churches that are located here. We had skilled tradesmen, knowledgeable people. Their penmanship in my church annual history book is better than any of ours. So you knew that they knew what they were doing, but it's a shame. And the land. Riceville Beach was primarily down on the Sound, was owned by African Americans. There are very small vestiges of that left now, but that was our land, a lot of that.
Jessica Franks, when we talk about African American history and the fact that February is Black History Month, do you also gain anything in the summer camp, or is there any place where you can learn about the positive history, the inspiring history, the history of ancestors who were who were artisans and inventors and engineers and, you know, great thinkers or theologians?
There's not much history here, because it's all about you actually having conversations with people who lived it.
So you're saying it comes from oral history. You're not really going to find it in a textbook.
You're not really going to find it in a textbook.
What does it mean for you as a person of color when you learn about those people?
I was actually shocked that a lot of this happened, because, like I said, you know, especially when I was in school, during Black History Month, we would learn about the same people, but none of these people lived in Wilmington, North Carolina. And so for me as a young person to really be able to talk to people who lived through certain situations, or for me to be able to go to certain sites that I've always been going to and not knowing how significant they were in the African-American history here in Wilmington, it means a whole lot, because you then begin to take a lot of things into consideration, and you look at a lot of things differently as well.
But what happened previously is that even the university here was more receptive into educating the community and African Americans. I don't know if you're aware that UNCW used to hold a weekend heritage school that anyone could attend, and it taught about the local history of African Americans in this community.
And is that still in?
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. We brought it up. It's not coming back. We are one of the few cities of our size not to hold a Children's Defense Fund Freedom School, which would also educate and keep our children occupied off the streets during the summer, since we say we're so concerned about gang violence and children getting in trouble.
The Confederate monuments, that has been a national discussion over the last couple of years. And, of course, we all know that Wilmington has two of them that kind of frame the entrance to downtown. Jessica Franks, as a younger person who grew up in Wilmington, did you grow up knowing what the significance of those monuments were?
Absolutely not.
When did you learn?
When I was in high school, actually. Unfortunately, I did not know anything about some of the monuments. A lot of those significant sites, of course, I learned during the Sankova camp, but I did not learn those monuments in school until I was in a college class, because I went to early college high school, and I was in my college history class, and that is where I learned a lot of those things.
And so what do you think about those monuments now when you see them?
They give me a sense of knowledge, knowing what my people had to go through when they lived during that time.
So this is something that I know some of our listeners are going to wonder if learning about some of these things, like 1898 and like the fact that some of these Confederate monuments went up as an affirmation of white supremacy,
yes,
long after the Civil War, they're going to worry that it will jaundice younger people against white people. In other words, like, does this Deborah Dix Maxwell perpetuate the racial divide by talking about it and saying to kids who were otherwise, what, perfectly happy and in an integrated space, is this perpetuating the divide?
We are not trying to perpetuate the divide, but we need truly educated citizenry to understand that racial injustice still occurs today and tomorrow, unless we educate everyone.
And so you're saying
they're integrated in school, but then they're also segregated a lot of times in school.
And what do you mean by that? Are you talking
segregated by
class size, low-performing schools, mm-hmm. majority-majority schools, majority-minority schools. Right. So that's a we're segregated across this school system.
Right. And that's something purposely. That's actually been established by a study done by the UNC
Anyone. Yeah.
Center for Civil Rights. Yeah, the numbers are high, and there is a link between high minority school populations and high poverty schools and low performing schools. And that is something that the new school board has taken on in the redistricting process as a priority. I mean, they've said that they're putting a diverse student body at the top of their list of priorities for their guiding principles for this redistricting process. Are you skeptical, Deborah Dix Maxwell?
I'm not skeptical about that, but my overriding goal is that they refocus on the low-performing schools that were by the previous administration made purposely magnet schools so no one else could come in, so that those children will have a chance before they go to middle school so that they can matriculate to high school and do well. But if you don't have that basic educational foundation called elementary school, you're in trouble. And not every child in Freeman Snipes is getting that. Some are and some are not.
Were the two of you part of the recent public meeting about the future of Williston?
The one at Williston I attended.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to go to break pretty soon, but where do you want to see that go? Where do you think it needs to go?
Back to the drawing board.
You're listening to Coastline, and I want to hear more about that when we come back. It's the 100th anniversary of the local chapter of the NAACP, and we have two local leaders with us answering your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this short break, we'll have one more segment for you to get your question or comment in, and we'll hear from Jim. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People launched in 1909. 10 years later, New Hanover County citizens, a diverse coalition of them, started a local chapter. This year, in 2019, that chapter is celebrating its 100th anniversary. Deborah Dix Maxwell is the president of the New Hanover County chapter, and Jessica Franks is president of the Wilmington NAACP Youth Council. She also chairs juvenile justice for the North Carolina NAACP Youth and College Division. You can ask your own question on this Thursday or make a comment by calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And just before we went to break, Deborah Dix Maxwell, you said they need to go back to the drawing board when it comes to what to do with Williston. And for those folks who don't know, Williston is currently a low-performing middle school in New Hanover County. It was a very well-regarded black high school.
Greatest school under the sun.
Right. And there, I mean, we've spoken with people who graduated from that high school during the time of segregation who said Williston is what launched them into a storied career or a life of accomplishment. So there's a lot of love for this school, and it's really rooted in the community, the history of it. So help us understand why folks in the community are not happy with the way the conversation really unfolded and what you're concerned about.
I'm concerned because first we were informed not as a community, but at a school board meeting. And so therefore, for Mr. Workman to come up with that, he must have had some comment or conversation with someone else on the board, I'm just assuming. And to make that when we're in the process of looking at middle school redistricting, you also have parents at Gregory who had promised their kids would matriculate over to Williston. For those who are new, Gregory is an international baccalaureate International Language Program?
Yes.
That moved just 2 years ago.
The Spanish Immersion
Program. Just moved from Forest Hills to Gregory with a promise they would go to Williston. And now you're not only smirching the memory of Williston, you're reneging on your promise to the parents of Gregory. My brother attended Williston, and so did my sister. And they both had excellent careers. My brother went on to Yale. And you can't say that every child from New Hanover can do that.
And are you saying your siblings went there when it was a segregated black high school?
Yes. And they were taught things that when he went to that stellar school, that some of his classmates from Choates and Exeter or whatever did not even get taught at their prestigious private schools their parents spent all that money for, but you were taught that at Williston.
And to be fair, we did hear from the board chair, Lisa Eastep, about the evolution of that idea, and there is an effort on the board to be more transparent, and because board members can't meet outside of the public view, she told us on this program that he kind of ran it by her and said, what do you think about my proposing this idea? And she said, sure, go ahead. And it seemed like it landed as a policy decision rather than the, what do you think about this idea that it was intended to be?
I think so. And we have to look at the reality of it. The legislature cut out the incentives for the film industry, so we don't have a lot of economic opportunities for actors and actresses locally anymore. We are suffering the effects and recovery of a hurricane, so we have a tremendous need for carpenters, electricians, plumbers, roofers, which are trade vocational, you know, and other things that are needed. And I don't think anyone in this area would disagree with that.
And so the idea then of turning this into a vocational school
is a possibility, and that is because of the requirements to go to school through Cape Fear are higher. Remember, we got low-performing schools. Those children will not make it into CTS based on what the educational foundation they are giving. So we have to offer another alternative. That's just today. Who knows what they will decide tomorrow or how I may feel on what they may present.
Jessica Franks, any thoughts about that?
She covered it.
Okay. We have an email from Jim, and just want to say this is Coastline, and of course, it's the 100th anniversary of the new Hanover County NAACP, so we're taking a look at what's happened over the last century and where equal rights for all is still more concept than reality. With us today, Deborah Dix Maxwell. She's president of the New Hanover County chapter of the NAACP, and Jessica Franks, president of the Wilmington NAACP Youth Council. She also chairs juvenile justice for the North Carolina NAACP Youth and College Division. You can ask your own question, a few minutes left, by calling us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. Jim asks, could we know more about the February 28th meeting and the presentation on the Green Book? So first, what is the Green Book for those folks who aren't familiar with it?
The Green Book, while it is a famous movie now, was a book that was made to show African Americans safe places to travel and lodge and eat as they went through this country, because it was dangerous at times to travel. Right. And so it was different places cited. And so we are going to have the only presentation from the North Carolina African American Historical Commission in this area. That's 7 o'clock, the 28th at St. Stephen AME Church, 501 Red Cross Street.
And we will put that on our website. Jim also asked, are the minutes and or records from the local chapter dating back to the founding of the organization?
I do not have the minutes or records dating back. We have been also, like some of our members, transient. And one member, secretary for 20 years, had a house burn, so a lot of things were lost at that time. But there are, if you have anything or know someone, please call me and get it to me.
All right. And we have Veronica from Leland. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. This is a comment about the Confederate statues that you talked about earlier.
Yes.
And also the kind of follow-up on the fact that our children and actually some of our adults aren't taught the whole history. I have a real problem with Confederate statues, one, as a woman of color, but more importantly, as an Army veteran. Those statues represent the only army that we celebrate here in the United States that actually fired on the Army of the United States, which would have been the Union Army. So if people want to tell the history, they should tell the entire history. One, that those statues were not put up in celebration of the Confederate veterans. It was put up in 1920s to celebrate really the rise of Jim Crow in the United States. And so if you want to put up statues, let's put statues up of Union soldiers that fought and were native North Carolinians who fought for the Army of the United States. Your thoughts on that?
Thank you so much. That's a great point, Veronica. Deborah Dix Maxwell.
Thank you for your comments. That is very appropriate. But as you know, everyone will say they're in a funding crisis. And the legislature, I believe, still has to say so on the removal of any Confederate memorials at this time. They threw that little extra protection clause in when they realized they would possibly be destroyed.
That's right. Jessica Franks, is that something that really lands on the radar of this younger generation? In terms of something that you need to address?
Absolutely. I feel as though that we, not even starting there, we need to start all the way back within our history to educate our younger generation. I do not believe that they are well-equipped and knowledgeable of all of the history that has went on.
You chair the state's Juvenile Justice for the Youth and College Division?
Yes.
What is the focus of that?
The focus of that is actually being or taking a stand for our youth that are in juvenile prison. So we with a lot of things, there are some of our younger people that age from 12 and up that have done something wrong, and the consequences that they have are absolutely out of this world. And it can be anything from something minor that they did that they have to spend like years in prison. And so that's one of the things that we advocate for our younger generation.
Are you saying that the penalties for people of color, even when we're talking about juveniles, are greater than the penalties would be for juvenile white kids, or are just greater than the crime, or both?
Greater than the crime.
And so what kinds of reforms do you think need to happen?
I would say one of the things that we need to look upon is actually going in and kind of looking at all of the facts. Because a lot of times what happens is when we go in and we look into a lot of the facts, we have gray areas instead of us going to smooth out those gray areas so where they can either be black or white, we just keep those gray areas and not understanding the full situation that happened.
When you look at you went to public school in New Hanover County, is
yes.
that right? So when you look at your public school career here, after you take into account the history that you learned about African American history, both locally and nationally and internationally, what do you think needs to happen in the public schools to enrich the experience of other kids who are missing out on that right now?
I think that one of the things that we need to do is equal opportunity for all. A lot of times what happens is, and I know that I can attest to it, that when I was in school, I was maybe one out of two minority students in my classroom. And so with that being said...
Was this all the way through your school career, like through high school?
Almost here? All through my school career, yes. A lot of times what happens is I have different opportunities than another person of color. And so one of the things that I would stress is equal opportunity for all of our students.
And how do we do that? I mean, that sounds like a great idea, and I'm sure a lot of listeners would be on board with that. But what does it look like, equal opportunity? What needs to change?
First, everyone has equity educationally, which means, like I said, we start from the beginning. We need to push for preschool for everyone. We need to test every child for AIG and not let a parent determine it. Because if I'm an African-American mother and I'm working, I'm happy my child got an A. I'm not always going to think about placing that child in AIG. And if I'm in a low-performing school, that teacher's going to be happy to keep my child in that class to keep her scores looking good. You know, it's a two-way street. Mm-hmm. So my child could be an AP child or given that incentive, and sometimes it doesn't happen. Or to have more diversity and expand and make educate, elevate the field by going to historical black colleges and universities and recruiting. UNCW has a primarily Caucasian educational department, and our children need diversity. So I encourage those of your people, go out there and volunteer at a school. Come to a school board meeting and change it so that Jessica is an example, but there's not. There should be more Jessicas coming out, and there aren't, okay? There really should be.
I want to go back to the history of the local chapter of the NAACP. It's 100 years ago, and you told our producer, Rachel Keith, that it was a diverse coalition of citizens who founded that chapter. Can you talk about who they were and why they came together 10 years in 1919?
Well, I was first telling about the 100, which was very diverse, black, white, Jewish, Gentile. A lot of the people at the initial group were ministers and some women, like Jessica and I have it here. We were lucky from the library to find out that the first president was Reverend A.F. Helms. And we had information on a lot of them. And but we don't have always their racial composition, but the NAACP has always been a diverse organization from the inception in 1909 as it continues today in 2019, because no one race or no one entity can change the problems of the world. It always takes a collaborative effort.
Do you know, was there a particular event that happened here around that time where local citizens said, okay, we need to form a chapter, we need to work for civil rights for all?
A lot of them, it said, were veterans. You have to remember that was World War I, with them coming home after probably facing discrimination during the war, which might have been a potential impetus for them.
When you look through the rest of this year, so coming up at the end of February, you have the presentation of the Green Book, which is it was a guidebook for people of color back in the era of segregation when it was dangerous for them to travel around and just show up at any hotel or motel. These were the safe places. What else do you have on the docket for 2019 in celebration of the 100th anniversary?
Well, we aren't finished with everything. We'll have our annual health fair recognizing Minority Health Month in April at the MLK Center. We will have our fantastic centennial celebration at the Wilmington Convention Center on Friday, May 31st of this year. We will have a 100 for 100 membership drive within the next 100 days leading up to our centennial to recruit 100 members. And other events to be scheduled. We want to also, he knows it, David Suseski to come back and be with us also.
David Suseski, the author.
Yes, we love him.
About Abraham Galloway, mm-hmm. His book. That's this edition of Coastline. Deborah Dix Maxwell, Jessica Franks, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.